Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is Richard Benulli. Today we have Adam Rosenzweig. He has worked exclusively on the Global Natural Resources Fund, partnered together with Mr. Gehring. Prior to this, Adam worked in the investment banking department at Lehman Brothers. Welcome, Adam.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for having me.
Great. I thought we'd do a focus today on the commodity markets and natural resources space. Just wondering what your thoughts are generally on those markets and what you see as the key drivers of that in terms of economic and financial fiscal stimulus drivers.
Sure. So I think, you know, the most important thing about the natural resource markets today in general and the energy markets in particular is how depressed they are. By any measure, they're basically as cheap as they've ever been, which in today's market is no small feat, given valuations, you know, across the board are quite stretched in a lot of different areas, notably in the tech sector. But for resources and for energy in particular, you know, we see things now as cheap as they've ever been. And to put this in perspective a little bit, energy made up 30% of the S&P 500 at its peak in 1980. And today it's less than 2.5% of the S&P 500. So just a massive value degradation. The way we look at commodities relative to stocks, we are now as cheap as we have been in 100 years. So there was three other times where we got close to where we are today, 1929, 1969, and 1999. And all three of those opportunities were fantastic times to become a natural resource investor. So we think this time will likely be as well. And today, resources, like I said, in general, and particularly energy, mostly oil and gas, it would be considered what I would call uninvestable, and by most people. And looking back over time, if you can stomach the volatility and you can take a little bit of a longer time horizon, investing in the uninvestable asset class has always, always, always been the right thing to do. And we think this time will be no different.
And which of those markets do you like, or do you like them in general? Like, do you focus on the energy markets, as you mentioned, or what about agriculture and precious metals, industrial metals?
So we do focus on all of them. And I think to some extent, you know, commodity prices likely bottomed, you know, for the most part between 2015 and 2016. But the big exception, and so, you know, really all have sort of have moved slowly up off the bottom, even though it's been really a wall of worry. But really where things are today, oil in particular, energy broadly, but oil in particular, I think represents the most exciting investment opportunity because it's the most out of favor. And it really does capture best that idea of, you know, the uninvestable today. And so that's where we actually think the biggest return potential is for clients going forward. And that's where we have the majority of our fund position today.
Mm-hmm. And do you see the drivers of these markets as being influenced by either monetary stimulus by central banks or fiscal stimulus by central banks and or governments, perhaps the modern monetary theory based finance of infrastructure projects, for example? What do you see as the key drivers today?
So I think it's really interesting how, you know, oil markets in particular are sort of setting up from the top down and from the bottoms up. And what do I mean by that? Well, most notably, from the bottoms up perspective, the thing that's going to dominate energy markets over the next 5 to 10 years is a question of supply. We simply are not spending enough money drilling oil wells. And I suppose that's, as you might expect, if oil prices plummeted the way they did and companies cut back their capital budgets and what have you. We're simply not drilling enough wells. And so we're seeing huge, huge, huge declines in supply across the board, notably in the U.S. shale production, which was the only bright spot in oil supply growth over the last decade. That's now running into some severe problems. So I think that the biggest story from a fundamental perspective will be this supply constraint that we're going to see in the energy space going forward. You know, I should point out that before COVID hit this year, you know, so at the end of 2019 and the beginning part of 2020, the shales actually stopped growing and they actually rolled over and started to decline a little bit. That was long before the impacts of COVID. And that was the result of we were running out of high quality shale inventory to drill. And since the shale wells declined so much in their first year, you have to be drilling more of them, more of them, more of them to help offset that decline. And if you stop running or if you start running out of high quality shale prospects to drill, it becomes harder to overcome that decline rate. So we started to see that happening at the end of 2019. And I think had it not been for COVID, that probably would have been one of the more important investment stories of this year. The idea that the shales, the big source of growth in the last decade, were starting to show signs of their age. With COVID, that's really accelerated things a lot because oil prices collapsed earlier this year. Companies laid down their rigs. And now, instead of gradually declining, shale production has plummeted. And the big impact now going forward is going to be this idea of, can you restart the shales? Can you turn them from declines back into growth? And I think that most investors are expecting that you can quite quickly, and we just don't think that's possible. It's struggling already, and those struggles are going to get much, much worse. So the fundamentals, from the bottoms up, if you will, are really, really constructive, I think, for oil and gas going forward. Looking at things from your perspective, from more of a macro perspective, that's an interesting story too, because you remember I told you 1929, 1969, and 1999, those were all the major market bottoms for commodities relative to financial assets. Those were all excellent times to get involved. And what do all those three dates have in common? They were all periods that had major monetary shifts to them. So in 1929, on the verge of the Great Depression, that was really the last gasp of the world trying to go back on gold. In 1969, everyone remembers the 1971 Nixon shock when Nixon, quote unquote, closed the gold window in 71. But what people actually forget is that the end of that cycle or the end of the Bretton Woods standard as we knew it was when Johnson removed the statutory backing of gold back in the dollar. It had been at 40 cents on the dollar before 68. And then it was removed legally in 68. That's what set up and allowed for the U.S. to go off gold. And so I would make the case that Bretton Woods actually ended in 68, 69, right coincident with when resources started outperforming relative to the broad market. And then in 1999, you had the whole Asian currency collapse. You had the whole emerging market debt issues. And that really sort of set up a new monetary regime that to a certain extent, we've been living with ever since. And so it's funny you bring up modern monetary theory or just basically changing rules of central banks in general, fiscal spending instead of monetary stimulus that we've enjoyed for the last 10 years with all of the issues associated with that. That would all be consistent with the past three cycles that have all ended and new commodity bull markets have been ushered in at the same time as you've had a shift in the global monetary system. And so I wouldn't be surprised if you do see it this time. And, we've been out saying that for a couple of years. We said, just going off of history, wait for a big shock to the monetary system before you can really see commodities start to rip higher and commodity equities start to rip higher. And lo and behold, I think we're living through that right now. The U.S., the Fed has basically abandoned its inflation. It's dual mandate, and now they're shooting for sort of above trend inflation in the Bank of England as well as the ECB. You basically are pretty close to directly monetizing a lot of the debt. Most of the sovereign debt in those regions are now being purchased by the central banks as opposed to 10 to 20% last year at the same time, in the US as well for that matter. The EU is talking about mutualization of risk across the various banks in the Eurozone, something that was really, really difficult to conceive of even a few years ago. So I think you're seeing a different role that central banks are going to take and are taking today compared to their typical playbook over the last 40 years. And so I think that all plays in with this new cycle is emerging. And it's going to be one that sees real asset prices outperform. And then, oddly enough, at the same time, that's coinciding perfectly well with this fundamental story, the supply story, because we just simply haven't been drilling enough wells in the oil industry. So I think it's all coming together.
Do you also see supply chain issues like supply chain disruption affecting agriculture and food prices in general, you know, sort of due to COVID?
Yeah, well, I think there's two issues. I mean, obviously the agricultural supply chain, you know, particularly I'm thinking of the meat processors and stuff like that, had some shocks to their system through COVID. So that has definitely happened. I think that's probably, you know, largely short term in nature. I mean, that's a true supply shock. I think that'll probably work its way through the system. But the more interesting story is what were to happen if you were to have a disappointment in global grain yields. And that might sound like a strange thing to say, but one thing that really does not get mentioned very often is that over the last 10 years, we have had, on a global basis, extremely unusual growing conditions. And what I mean by that is they have been very, very, very supportive of high grain yields. And that's been true in North America, South America, and Europe. So it's very rare that you would have, first of all three, you know, major grain growing regions all exhibiting favorable conditions in a year. And it's particularly notable to have such a long period, you know, 10 plus years of extremely good growing conditions. What has that done? Well, it's resulted in grain yields and crop yields that are, you know, real bin busters. They really have sort of, you know, blown out the old averages and the old records, to the point that, you know, if we were to get even an average grain yield again, going back over like the 20-year averages, you would tighten the markets very, very, very quickly. So, you know, taking a step back, what I mean by all this is that the grain markets, and this has been true for a couple of years now, have been more or less priced to perfection, because we have become very, very used to extremely high yields. Now, what were to happen if we ever sort of broke that trend? And one of the things that could do that, I mean, it could just be sort of simple reversion to the mean. But the other thing, and this, you know, might be a little controversial, there has been a lot of studies over many periods, long periods of time, about the relationship between sunspot activity and global growing conditions going back hundreds and hundreds of years. And it does turn out that in periods like the one we have just gone through, they do tend to be associated with fairly good growing conditions. Now we've just entered into a new sunspot cycle, and to the extent that this one is different and you know, the sort of mirror image of what we just went through, could that mean that the growing conditions we have experienced might not persist? We don't know. Nobody knows really. But you know, one thing that is certain is we've become really lulled into a false sense of security, I think, by getting used to these extremely high growing conditions year after year after year.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Now, you mentioned oil. What about in the post-COVID era? We hear of this initiative from the World Economic Forum called the Great Reset. And there's a lot of emphasis from that initiative that is against the use of oil and other types of fossil fuels, as well as also on the meats like live cattle, hogs, you know, those commodity markets. What are your thoughts on that initiative, and could this be potentially negative for those markets?
Well, I think that we've seen a huge increase in ESG style investing and environmental sensitivity amongst investors over the last five years or so. And I think that's certainly accelerated in the last 2 or 3 years. And I think that's part of the reason why you can explain energy's weighting in the S&P 500 at, you know, less than 3% now from a high of 30 back in 1980. So I think from an investor standpoint, probably a lot of that selling pressure is, I would say, largely done at this point. You know, I don't know many institutions that are sort of on the fence about conventional energy that's still in their positions. So I think if anything, the risk is that people might find themselves underexposed to the energy sector if, you know, despite everyone's best efforts, if you didn't get a rally in oil prices, for instance, because, you know, we're simply not drilling enough wells. And I think at that point, you know, active managers will be the first to move into the energy space because they'll realize that at such a low weighting in the index, if they just add a little bit of energy to their portfolio, they can probably drastically outperform. And then from there, you know, you'll develop momentum in the names and things of that nature, because there's just simply no one owns them anymore. So you'll have money rushing in as opposed to money rushing out, which has been the standard for the last 5 years. So I think from an investor perspective, at least in the short and short to medium term, I think it's probably actually could be a tailwind, because I think a lot of the selling pressure is already done. But the bigger picture, you know, of whether or not the world can move away from an oil-based economy, I think that's a more interesting question. And it's one that we, as you might imagine, do a lot of work about here at Gehring and Rosenzweig. And we write about it quite a bit in our letters, too. So I'd invite your listeners to go take a look at our quarterly letters, which we put on our website. We make available to everybody. But one of the things that we have noticed is that there's a real bottleneck in the widespread adoption of electric vehicles. And that bottleneck is the battery. So people don't, I don't think, fully appreciate that, you know, if you buy a Tesla, for instance, you know, 35 to 50% of the value of the car is actually coming in the form of the battery when you buy it. And that battery, there's some debate. There's different sort of groups of people, you know, are pushing different agendas and whatnot. But basically, that battery has a finite life to it. And it probably is somewhere in the order of 500 full recharge cycles before you start to see really, really large degradation in the capacity of that battery. And so you have to amortize, you know, that cost. And so it's funny, I've spoken to a lot of people that own a Tesla, and they say, you know, the great thing about this Tesla is that I don't have to, I hardly have to take it into the garage anymore. And I don't mean to sort of pick on Tesla. This is true of any electric vehicle. They say, you know, I don't have to take it into the garage to get serviced anymore. I'm saving all this time and money. But what they don't realize is, to some extent, they're deferring all that maintenance to one giant maintenance, which is the repair replacement of the battery, after its useful life. So, you know, we do a lot of work on that bottleneck, that battery technology, in order to try to see whether or not there is sort of something out there on the horizon that can really change the game here. And as of now, we really haven't seen anything that would fit that bill. So, you know, I think some of the announcements at the recent Tesla Battery Day have been pretty interesting. You know, obviously the market did not respond well to that. They felt that it was sort of, a little bit of a letdown in terms of big announcements. But some of the language I thought was kind of interesting, including the idea that Tesla announced that they expect within a few years to have a fairly large breakthrough in battery technology, and that finally that will allow them to realize their long-term vision of having a mass market adoptable electric vehicle. And I thought that was kind of interesting, because while the bulls sort of spun that into we're on the verge of this great breakthrough, it was sort of the first time that anyone had ever admitted that as of today, we don't have the technology, we don't have in particular the battery technology to really allow for that widespread adoption of mass market electric vehicles to the way that we would like. So, that's always been our contention, and I think that that's starting to bear out now. So, I think that ultimately, if we're serious about reducing global carbon, which I think is most people are at this point, I think that the best way, frankly, to do that is not at this point to try to pursue an electric vehicle mandate, which first of all depends on your source of electricity. If you were to switch internal combustion into EV from big parts of the United States, you probably wouldn't see much of a reduction in CO2 at all, because we generate a lot of power from coal. But second of all, auto emissions are only a quarter of total global CO2 emissions. And the other one that I find very strange, that's really been fixated on, has been meat consumption. That's also very, very small. The vast majority of global CO2 comes from electricity generation and industrial manufacturing. And so I think that should be what we probably start to try to address CO2. And that's why I think that the best source for long-term carbon-free power is likely nuclear as opposed to renewables. And the reason for that is that renewables suffer from what's known as the intermittency problem. Namely, they have difficulty, and obviously they can't dispatch power, solar power when the sun's not shining, and wind power when the wind's not blowing. So until you kind of address that, you can't smooth out that power. You'll need some kind of baseload backing up the renewables. And so we think that nuclear ultimately is a great source of carbon free electricity, which could do a huge amount to help reduce global CO2. But I think fixating on internal combustion engines and gasoline until you have a reasonable or viable technology for the battery, I think doesn't really achieve the goal that you're looking for. And I think, you know, pushing a renewables mandate that has to be backed up by some other source of electricity because of intermittency, again, doesn't really cut it. So I think that, you know, ultimately we could probably learn to live with automobiles, internal combustion engines, and a big push towards nuclear power. And that's ultimately how we have the portfolio position.
Mm-hmm. Great points. Yeah, I totally agree. I actually did some work myself on nuclear fusion energy development. The question on inflation. So how do you see the commodity inflation if we have commodity producers, you know, involved with the rise in the commodity prices? How would that translate to actual CPI inflation or would it necessarily? And like, to what extent do commodity consumers use hedging strategies? How long does that effect take place? Like commodity consumers that are in need of wheat or copper, you know, how do they actually do the hedging? And how long is that process before you have rising commodity prices just taking over and translating into a CPI inflation?
Well, I would say, and the short answer is, you know, I guess it depends a little bit industry by industry, but I would say that very few people are probably hedged more than a year or two out, you know, whether that's the oil companies or the airlines or the refiners or what have you. You know, it's really sort of most of the activity on the futures curve tends to be 1 and 2 years out. Mm-hmm. So I think that in the past, the idea of rising commodity prices and an inflationary environment, that obviously brings to mind the 1970s, where commodities across the board all did very, very well. And that was during a period of intense inflationary activity. More recently, I suppose we had a more benign inflationary environment from 2000 to 2010, which was, you know, the last sort of commodity bull market. You know, oil went from 11 to 145, gold went from 260 all the way up to 1900. And copper from 50 cents up to over $4, stuff like that. But it was also associated with a, you know, fairly benign inflationary environment. And I think that that was largely the result of, you know, some labor disinflation being exported by the emerging markets in China and things of that nature. You know, another sort of interesting commodity bull market, which nobody would really expect, was that, you know, from 1929 to 1938, you know, at the onset of the Depression, through the Depression, obviously, gold did very, very well, and that was the only place to really store your value. But believe it or not, oil finished the decade, you know, not far off where it started, and oil stocks were actually up a little bit. Copper stocks were up a little bit, and the broad market was off 50 or 60% still at that point. So, and that obviously is associated with a period of huge deflation and depression. So we've actually seen commodities do well in inflationary periods for sure. And the most notable, like I said, was the 70s. But we also saw commodities do well during periods of deflation through the Depression and through periods of, you know, sort of middle of the road. So I guess strictly speaking, you know, if you want to be sort of academic about it, if you have rising commodity costs, either everyone will sort of pass those along, in which case you'll have rising CPI. Or I suppose the other alternative would be that they don't get passed along, in which case you would have eroding profit margins at everyone, you know, involved in the middle of the supply chain. But I guess that's sort of a bit of a trivial answer because it has to be one or the other. But we have seen commodities do well in both deflationary and inflationary periods.
Mm-hmm. And final question is on how to best invest or trade in the commodity markets and natural resource sectors. What do you do? How do you work with your clients? And how do you handle like contango if you're using even ETFs, for example?
Yeah, and that's a great point. We invest in the equities. So that's where we think the best way to express our views in the commodity markets resides. And that's how we've always operated. So we are natural resource equity investors, and that's what we've always been. That's where our specialty lies. The problem with the futures market is exactly like you said, the contango, or the fact that futures, commodity prices out in the future tend to be higher under normal circumstances than they are in the present. And the reason for that is a function of storage costs and interest rate costs and things of that nature. But what it means for the end investor is that if you invest in a futures-based strategy, you're constantly having to roll the current contract out to the future contract. And so there is fairly substantial slippage to that. There's periods of time where that contango is steeper and that's more of an impact, and times where it's shallower, or even what they call backwardized, which is where the futures price is lower than the spot price. But you know, the slippage over the full cycle can be quite substantial. So I think that that's really sort of means that you have to sort of invest in the equities if you want to get exposure, and that's what we do. So what we like to focus on, companies that will respond to the move that we anticipate, the commodity price. So they have the directional exposure that we're trying to take on. That's very important, obviously, to us. So we like companies that do have exposure to commodity prices. And then we like to make sure that they are positioned with high quality assets that could withstand an adverse move in the commodity price if need be. So that's how we kind of try to balance risk and return. Our return is based on where we think the commodity price is going to go, but we'd like to make sure that they can weather the storm if we're wrong. Not to say that the stocks will do well if we're wrong on the commodity price, because that would be too good to be true, right? Something that goes up when the commodity price goes up, but doesn't go down when the commodity price goes down. If you could find that, that'd be wonderful. So that's not going to be possible, but we at least want to make sure that it'll go up if the commodity price goes up, and it won't go bankrupt if the commodity price goes down. And that way we can leave ourselves a lot of runway to try and realize our fundamental views of the commodities. And that's been our strategy forever. That's the same thing that we do today.
Well, great insight, Adam. How can our listeners learn more about your work?
Well, like I said, we publish quite a bit of our research to our website. It's available at GoRozen, GoRozen.com. And we do quite a few, speeches and speaking engagements and things of that nature. And everything is on our website. So, you know, we believe in trying to be as transparent as possible. We like to put all of our work out into the public domain. And so it's all there for, including all of our archived work, where you can see where we went right and wrong in the past as well. And that's all available on our website to anybody.
Great. Thank you so much, Adam. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.